Hello, everybody. My name is Jacek Bartosiak. Welcome to Strategy in Future. And today, a long-awaited guest, James Kimofaneo, retired U.S. Navy captain and a former director of intelligence of U.S. Pacific Fleet. Hello, James. How are you?
Good day, Jacek. It's great to see you again.
Yeah. We talk from time to time, usually like year by year. Basically, these are the gaps, time gaps that we interact on this China thing. And I think it has been several months since we last talked. You sounded very sober in terms of the conflict and the tensions between US and China. And let's get started from this point. We are recording our conversation on the 22nd of January, 2024. The elections in Taiwan are already behind us. The elections in US are coming, and the election year is coming, which I think is quite important to understand the dynamics. We have had several issues, purging within the artillery force of the Chinese People's Republic. We have some special speeches by Xi Jinping about the conflict between US and China. We have a major deglobalization trend. We have a major technology dispute between US and China. We have sanction regime. We have a lot of stuff hanging in the air. Structural forces are driving events a bit. What do you make out of this in the context of the Taiwanese elections and the election years and the purging? Let's start with general assessment. What do you make out of all this that is happening, Kimo?
Well, Jacek, I think in terms of the election in Taiwan, I think what we've seen is obviously 23 million people represented and a clear statement that they want to have their say in their own self-determination of their governance. And so I think the message to not just the world, but to Beijing in particular is that this idea that they were going to be able to use what they call comprehensive national power to get the people of Taiwan to come to some kind of political solution to try to force this, what the Chinese call, the PRC calls reunification, which nobody else acknowledges that it was ever unified in the first place. But that idea that diplomatic efforts, pressures to get nations to not recognize Taiwan, which have been very successful since Xi's been in power, economic leverages, economic pressures, information warfare, all of that the party had tried to use. And I think they legitimately believe that if they could pressurize enough, like they did in Hong Kong, for example, that they could force some kind of political outcome that could be acceptable, that Xi could then sell to the people of China that they had somehow been able to restore the territorial integrity of they say China, but it's clearly what they believe is the People's Republic of China. And so that has clearly failed. And this election has shown that the people of Taiwan weren't bullied into making a change and saying, well, we need to go with a party that's not going to be as quote unquote provocative, that will cause Beijing to launch an invasion. They were willing to stay with the Democratic Progressive Party, despite domestic issues with the economy and other, progressive movements or social issues that maybe some people in Taiwan didn't like. The fact remains that the majority of the people said, we want this party because on the fundamental issue of our right to determine our self-governance, we don't want to change that. And so I think the message to Beijing is, and I think, and I wrote this in my, now many, many years ago, that this decade of concern that we're in, 2020 to 2030, that, when Hu Jintao and Xi Jinping ordered the PLA to be ready by 2020 to have the military capability to take Taiwan, I then argued that, Beijing would continue to try to use non-kinetic measures to force Taiwan to come to some kind of political solution. But I said, as the decade wears on, there will be increasingly more voices in Beijing that will argue for and state that the non-kinetic measures are not working, and therefore we're going to have to use the military lever. And now this election will only add fuel to that fire. And so I think right now we're at a point where the politically Beijing's finding themselves in a tough position.
Okay, so that's your assessment, that the outcome of the elections has put the Beijing government in the awkward position that they need to start doing something. Now the question is, you know, in the election year in the United States, about the rhetorics that the candidates are having, I think this is a unison front, despite the strategic failures of the U.S. strategic community to approach the rise of China that you have described in your newest book. We will touch upon this issue in a moment. But, you know, there is an election year. It seems when I'm in Eurasia, when I look at the things from Eurasian, you know, from Poland, I can see that there is a united front to confront China and the U.S. establishment, regardless of the candidate origins, whether this is a Democratic Party candidate or Republican Party or the Congress. So how do you think the rhetorics that will be abandoned during the election year in the United States, anti-China sanction regime, you know, sort of tariffs, technology war, stealing of technology, all those rhetorics, how can it fuel also the sort of the path to confrontation looming somewhere in the autumn or in the spring of 2025 that some analysts are predicting that might occur? But do you think that this will be a factor? And that will be a good, you know, sort of a gateway to start talking about whether it's U.S. strategic community has made failure after failure in approaching the rise of China.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned this word bipartisan consensus, or you alluded to it. And I would say that that's, you know, one of the same strategic community, this national security apparatus in Washington, had been talking it up over the last couple of years, saying that, you know, of all the things, the transition from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, we saw almost a universal rejection of everything that Trump did, whether it was oil pipelines, whether it was borders, whether it was taxes, whether it was regulations. You know, literally in the first 100 days, the Biden administration said, if Trump did it this way, we're doing it that way. But there was this one exception, and that was on the policy towards China. And everybody then took that on and said, see, there's a bipartisan consensus. And I think that there are some folks on the Democrat Party side that saw that China was more of a threat than they had seen and admitted over the previous 40 years. However, what I would submit to you is that bipartisan consensus is not real, not really a true bipartisan consensus like we had more so in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. And why I say that is, just go back to last May when the CIA director made a secret trip to Beijing to try to open up negotiations with the Chinese to restore engagement and mill-to-mill and people-to-people exchanges, and then followed the next very month in June by Secretary of State Blinken, and then the Secretary of Treasury Yellen, and then this climate czar, John Kerry, and then the late Henry Kissinger, who was not in the government, but was certainly a representation of this kind of bipartisan effort. And then followed up by, you know, Secretary Raimondo and all of these secretaries, cabinet officials from May, June, July, and into October, all going there and basically saying, we're now done with this confrontational approach that the Trump administration brought in, and we want to get back to engaging. And we had the commander of Indo-Pacific Command, you know, was on the public broadcasting service, was on major news outlets talking about how he had been begging his counterpart for a year and a half in the Chinese military to have, you know, talks, counterpart talks. Secretary of Defense had said that. So this is one of the major elements that the U.S. had been signaling for a six-month period. And then you go to San Francisco, to Woodlands, and one of the probably the only thing that came out of Woodlands was this announcement that we're going to resume military-to-military engagement, as if that was a panacea. which to me, and the book we just wrote with Dr. Brad Thayer, is exemplifies the past 40 years of failure to understand strategic thinking. And so what I would say today is we are not at a bipartisan consensus, and I think that's very much the concern heading into the November election. Is, you know, one party has staked out a position on China that's pretty tough. And there's another party that has maintained some of those strictures in place, put some things in place in some chip sanctions and chip tariffs, but they have clearly signaled that they want to go back to the pre-Trump era, the Obama era of engagement, because there's this idea that if we talk some more, then China will change its behavior, despite 40 years of talking with China and their behavior becoming more belligerent and more aggressive.
Yeah, but that's a good moment to expand. Could you expand on your thesis with a friend of yours? You wrote a book about strategic failures. Could you expand the main topics and, you know, tell us more about the book, the title of it and stuff? I think it would be highly interesting for our viewers.
Sure. It's just come out. It's available on any of the book sites that you purchase books at, from Amazon to whatever. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing, and it's entitled Embracing Communist China, America's Greatest Strategic Failure. And it's an examination of the U.S. national security community from the presidency down into the departments of our government. And it looks at history. And it talks about grand strategy and what are the elements of grand strategy and how we ignored grand strategy for a variety of reasons, whether it was the current wars in the Middle East or whether it was a kind of an arrogance or an ignorance of communism, and that how these strategy folks, both in the national security arena in the Department of Defense, in the State Department, failed to completely understand the Chinese Communist Party's grand strategy towards the United States and hence the rest of the world. And then we go through and we examine the different administrations going back to President Clinton. We examine, and this is kind of where some of my expertise came into the book, was we examined the intelligence community, where there was intelligence estimates that were what we use the term using threat deflation, this constant obsession to deflate the threat of the PLA. And we have records of that, and we talk about, you know, where we said this or where we didn't estimate, you know, certain things that would happen. And then lastly, we talk about the U.S. Navy and how U.S. Navy admirals didn't do anything for 25 years, even though every year we had more and more evidence to show that, you know, like the Congressional Research Service shows over a 20-year span, how the United States had, like in 2005, a 75 combatant warship advantage over the PLA, and now the Chinese have 135 ship advantage over, you know, a 18-20 year period. And every year that was being published by just the Congressional Research Service, let alone some other agencies, and no one responded in the Pentagon. Not one admiral resigned in protest. But when you go back to the 1940s, we had what they called the Revolt of the Admirals, where our admirals revolted about plans that the new Secretary of Defense had to, you know, put everything in our defense budgets, kind of not everything, but the majority of it, into a new strategic bomber. And they killed essentially the new follow-on aircraft carriers that were going to be coming out. And so Navy Admiral said, I don't think that's a good idea.
Do you mean that was Carl Vinson reforms in the 30s, late 30s, or after the Second World War?
After. I'm talking in the 49, what was called the Revolt of the Admirals. And so there was a push to build a super a plane. The name of the plane's escaping, B-36. And it was going to be the strategic bomber that was going to basically, those that were running the Pentagon at that time, right when the 1947 National Security Act created the Defense Department, created the Pentagon, and within a couple of years, those experts that kind of populated this new defense establishment had it in their minds that now that World War II's over and everything's solved, we don't need we don't need a Navy, and we don't really need a separate Air Force. We just need one department. We'll call it the Defense Department. It'll largely be run by Army officers. And we'll have an air arm because the air arm of the Air Force, which is part of the Army, can do anything that the Navy's carriers can do. And we'll just threaten everybody with nuclear bombardment with these new strategic bombers. And the Navy admirals at the time said, that's not good. We're not balanced. It's not holistic. We need to have carriers that can project power into different areas. Yeah. We need to have layers of deterrence, not just one hammer. We need to have many layers of deterrence. And so these admirals said, and they internally said, this is not right. And it kept getting ignored. So they went public. And they, most of these admirals got cashiered, got pushed out. Not all of them, but most of them. And but what it did is it sent a signal inside the U.S. system that, hey, when there's something not right, you have a responsibility to stand up and speak out. Now, you're going to most likely lose your job because we have civilian control of the military. But if you really have a professional opinion, you should be willing to risk your career to state that. And so that happened. That's history. Arleigh Burke survived and came out of that and actually led kind of the Navy's portion of the Cold War development and the development of our supercarriers and nuclear carriers. And thanks to him and guys like him that you know, didn't just acquiesce and go along with the crowd. So now here we are, you know, 60 years later, just about, and we have a group of admirals over the last 20, 30 years that didn't do that. And so now we're in a position where the Chinese Navy is the largest in the world, has the most tonnage produced in the last decade, has the most anti-ship cruise missiles, has anti-ship ballistic missiles. We just saw the Houthis in the Red Sea actually shoot an anti-ship ballistic missile. So that cork is out of the bottle, and that, you know, and that's going to unleash a whole new level of warfare around the
and
world.
And it hit the target, didn't it? What's the real intelligence from that?
The assessments are that I've read so far is that it did. Now, it had a smaller warhead and it didn't sink the ship. But the point is that a ship at sea moving and got hit by a ballistic missile. So, and you know that the Chinese have been working on this technology for, you know, 20 years at least. So I know that. So the point is that we're moving into a new arena, and we were the whole reason that the out of World War II that they created and Truman agreed to this National Security Act, and it took several months of negotiating between Democrats and Republicans when there really was a bipartisan consensus about fear of the Soviet Union and the threat of worldwide communism, was that the Department of Defense was formed out of the War Department, the Army, and the Navy Department, combined all that, created this Pentagon. And their main objective was to look ahead so that we were never surprised again, like on Pearl Harbor, that we were never surprised and out of position to allow something like that happened in Europe. And throughout the Cold War, the Pentagon continued to look ahead. We had guys like Dr. Andy Marshall, the Office of Net Assessment, that for five or more presidents was advising them, here's where the threats are coming in the future. Here's the new technologies. Here's what we need to think and do and look ahead. And then you get to the Clinton administration, the end of the Bush administration, and after the wall came down and this, you know, so-called, as Fukuyama called it, the end of history, there was this kind of an arrogance on our side that it's history's over, everybody's going to become a democracy, and we can let our guard down. And then we got obsessed with the Middle East. And then we didn't do our due diligence. And when the Middle East war started, you had a former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, basically fire and cashier Secretary of the Air Force, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, for minor, not minor, but some infractions. But the real reason was because they were coming to him and saying, hey, we got concerns about the PRC in 30 years from now or 20 years from now. We need to be doing and building towards that. And Gates said, I don't need this. I need to fight today's war. So if you're not coming to me to tell me how to fight today's war, then I don't want to talk to you. And so we label that as this, and it's been labeled as this kind of whataboutism. It's about this, or it's this idea that I have to deal with today. And it's a complete reversal of the grand thinking and strategy that dominated the U.S. national security community throughout the Cold War, which is to look far ahead. And we didn't do that. And so we go through and we outline the history of that, the components of that, and then we make some recommendations at the end of the book. We think it's a good read. It's well sourced, but it gets to the crux of this idea of not identifying your primary threat. We didn't do that. We got upset.
Prioritization, which is also part of grand strategy. What, for example, you know, in concrete terms, you mentioned several times now that, you know, mil to mil, this military to military, you know, interactions, so that to prohibit from some escalation happening and so on. This is at least what is being sold publicly by the politicians. So, what as a former intelligence chief of the Pacific Fleet, why do you think it's a bad idea for the U.S. or for maybe good for China? Could we look at it strategically? In whose favor, in whose interest that would be, or against whose interest that would be? Can we try to disseminate what that would mean, and maybe that why we shouldn't have it?
Two parts of that. One is, when I talk about this, it automatically gets interpreted kind of like you just did, which is, well, he must not want any engagement at all. And I'm not promoting that. What I'm saying, though, is there's a way to use engagement just like you use diplomacy. And the fact that we had a commander of Indo-Pacific Command going out publicly for a year and a half and publicly stating in the press, I really want to talk to my counterpart, but he won't talk to me. Mm-hmm. The Secretary of Defense, I really want to talk to my counterpart.
That's true.
I mean, if you completely lose any ability to have any influence or leverage in what those negotiations should be about, right? You do the mill-to-mill engagement. You have diplomacy for not to acquiesce to your adversary, but to be able to gain some advantages and agreements. And you can't just do that by saying, I want to talk to you. They know that. They use that against us. And then I look at things like, for instance, the Western Pacific Naval Symposium that was just held here in China. Second time they've held it, that the Chinese have hosted it. And when you looked at the agenda, they were still, again, I was involved with one of the last ones that was in China in 2014. So it was 10 years ago. And when you look at the agenda from 2014 and you look at the agenda from 2024, you're like, what's changed? So we're having all these negotiations about code for unencountered events at sea, Qs, unencountered events at sea, code for unencountered or unplanned events at sea, CUES, Qs. And Qs came up and was created in around the 2014 timeframe. And it was an idea that we said, if we can get the Chinese to kind of sign into, they didn't want to use the term INC, Incidents at Sea Agreement, which is what the U.S. and the Soviets had during the Cold War, that we had an agreement on how we would relate if we encountered each other at sea, incidents at sea. So we came up with a new acronym, Qs. And the idea was, is that if our ships get close to each other, because there was this thesis that, oh my gosh, if two U.S. and a Chinese ship collided, it would start a thermonuclear war. We'd go right into thermonuclear war. There wouldn't be no gradations, no shades of gray. It would just go from nothing sailing in the South China Sea to thermonuclear war. And so they said, we got to have some apparatus that we can talk to each other and flashlights and talk and we'll keep the temperature down. Well, you've been talking about cues for a decade. So how hard is it to keep talking about the same thing? Or let me put it in another example.
So what are the Chinese are doing? So why are they doing it? Because maybe it's in their interest that the Americans are afraid of some, you know, operations of, you know, freedom of navigation operations and sailing, and having some encounters or collisions, so that the Americans have second thoughts whether to sail in the first place, and that slowly but steadily is favoring the Chinese political agenda to phase out the U.S.
That's exactly it. They're trying to use these kind of dialogues as an effort to constrain U.S. activities in the region. Let me give you another example. The declaration on the code of conduct. 1999, there was disputes in the South China Sea. It had come from the Chinese seizing mischievery from the Philippines and some activities against the Vietnamese, murdering Vietnamese sailors and stuff. And so in 1999, the Filipinos were very afraid that China was going to take one of their shoals off of Palawan called Second Thomas Shoal. And the Filipinos in 1999 had virtually no navy except what we had bequeathed to them after World War II. They had, you know, some old ships. So they ran one of them aground at Second Thomas Shoal, they call the Sierra Madre.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's there now. It's 25 years later. They ran it aground, and the Chinese got so upset, so they pressed the ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, to come together and let's talk about how we can have a code of conduct. But first, we'll have a declaration on a code of conduct. And that had agreement, and they signed it, but it was legally non-binding, but it had eight elements. And it basically said, no one will use unilateral force down there. No one will try to inhibit or hurt individuals or humans. Like the resupply of food and water. That's kind of one of the major elements. And a number of things it said that these nations would try to live together and come to a non-violent agreement on these territorial disputes. Well, here we are 25 years later, and China keeps talking about what we need is a code of conduct now. We need a code of conduct. We need a code of conduct. And they throw that out over and over again. And what has it done? In that 25-year period, China went from really not having any physical holdings in the South China Sea to today, they have control of Scarborough Shoal that they took in 2012. They built seven islands, three of which are the size of Pearl Harbor, that have 10,000-foot runway, 3,000-meter runways. They have pier space, major naval bases, three of them, plus these other intelligence kind of bases for SIGINT collection and other things. And then they've installed that from 2013 to 2015. They had a president, Xi Jinping, a general secretary, that promised our president that he would not militarize them. They're completely militarized now. They're full of surface-to-air missiles. They're full of fighters and bombers and naval ships and submarines. And they're operating out of there. And they're threatening now other holdings from the Philippines and Vietnam and other nations down there, even non-South China Sea claimed nations like Indonesia. So China, in the course of that quarter of a century, they used the annual meetings of Code of Conduct, or the DOC, to try to basically constrain anybody from stopping their activity. So when the U.S., when China, it was not very long that the Chinese didn't talk with us. It was after Pelosi's visit where they cut off the mill to mill.
Yeah.
When she visited for that less than 24-hour period, the People's Republic of China said, mill to mill's off. And from that day forward, the U.S., this administration, acted like a jilted lover. When you're a boyfriend and a girlfriend and you call each other, and then one says, I don't think we should go out. And he doesn't answer the phone. Or the other way, the girl says, I don't want to go out with you. And the guy keeps calling every day. Please talk to me. Please talk to me. Please talk to me. I want to talk to you. Can't we talk? That's what America was doing. And the Chinese let it go. They thought, okay, great. This is good. And then they used that to be able to get in and get this administration to basically agree to meet with them and to say the right things and continue the One China principle and to do everything in their power to dissuade the U.S. from ramping up what should really be ramping up of what Trump did. They didn't do that, and they eased some of it. And in other areas, they've actually detracted from the gains, I would call them gains, that the Trump administration made in terms of alliances and bilateral and multilateral relationships. Quad may be an exception, but in terms of the Quad, you haven't seen big, major U.S., Indian, Australian, and Japanese carrier exercises like you did in Malabar in, I think it was 2019 or 2020. And you have some indicators out of India that they don't feel like this administration really cares about India's participation in Quad. I'm getting words out of Korea that the Koreans are very worried about things. Certainly, the Philippines has been an exception, but they're not linking it to the United States per se. I think it's President Marcos has been very clear that they're not going to have their sovereignty infringed in the South China Sea. Yeah. So I guess what I'd say is this administration allowed themselves to be, again, like this classic mistake that we describe in our book. They put this idea of engaging and talking above hard politics, hard policy. And then what they did is they signaled their hand. And it was all for a belief that if they talked, things would get better, even though the evidence is empirically shown that things get worse.
Mm-hmm. Since you are the former chief intelligence of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, let's talk about the numbers and the operation capabilities. At the end of the day, these are the capabilities that matter, or at least signal the intentions. Intentions are always unclear, yeah, between nations. And so that's why we try to derive some intentions from capabilities. So, you know, from the intelligence perspective, how would you describe the Chinese intentions from how they build up their fleet, how they use their fleet, how they train their fleet, how the operational capabilities are being mastered? Maybe less about numbers, because, you know, everybody can check it in the internet, but tell me more about this, you know, the real essence of skills, what they are training, what the Chinese are training for, and what the American response is, and whether this is good enough.
Well, briefly on the numbers, I would just say numbers matter. You know, the old saying that quantity has a quality all of its own. So yeah. In that regard, that makes it much harder for the United States 7th Fleet to be able to, execute a mission of, say, defending Taiwan or stopping the Chinese from taking aggression in the South China Sea against the Philippines, an ally, or something worse against Japan. So the numbers are, you know, the Chinese have clearly staked out 25 years ago that they wanted to have a large navy. And there was this, I think, debate in China, because it's basically been a land power for the last 7 centuries since Admiral Zheng He sailed. And you can debate whether or not even then China was really a maritime power in any way. But let's just go with that. So that was in the 1400s. So, and that quickly shut down in the early 1500s. So basically, for the last 600-700 years, the People's Republic of China, or the Chinese mainland, has been focused on land warfare. But it was only in the last, you know, several decades since Admiral Liu Hua-Cheng, who was, you know, in with Deng Xiaoping, that they said they wanted to have a navy. That navy really didn't start to be built until 2000, in my opinion. That's really when things really started to take off. And here in the last, as I mentioned earlier, in the last decade, China's outproduced the United States in total numbers of ships, built, commissioned, tonnage, which I think people don't really recognize. So they've pumped out 8 of these Type 075 amphibious attack helicopters. Those are 40,000 tons. They pumped out 8 of them. We have pumped out a couple, and one of ours, the Bonhomme Richard, you know, burned up at the piers in San Diego. So we had, a net zero. Well, they were making 4 in a year and a half or 3 years. I mean, so 3 years. So, I mean, they're really ramping up large-scale production across a variety of platforms. The Type 055 cruisers with 112 vertical launch cells. So you have this idea that they're creating their own strike groups, carrier strike groups and amphibious strike groups or expeditionary strike groups. And those are all mature right now.
James, we'll continue, but let me just, you know, challenge you a little bit. Because in Europe, people, you know, keep talking, yeah, it's a literal navy. You know, the Chinese can never take on the U.S., major combatants. It's not how you calculate, not the numbers, but operational capabilities, experience. So it's a far cry from the U.S. Navy. It will take them 50 years at least, you know, to catch up on the U.S. Basically, this is what you hear, as you know, probably, across Europe. So the Americans are just inflating it. They are just, you know, just doing it on purpose, you know, to let us, keep on leash, so to speak, so that we are preoccupied and we shouldn't. the Chinese will never take on the American Navy. The American Navy's superb fighting power. And, you know, the you're mentioning frigates, destroyers, you're mentioning missiles, you know, when you have talked now. Could you translate it for our viewers,
yeah,
what it means in terms of what it signals, what kind of navy they are producing? What?
Well, I'm getting to that. But first, you have to kind of lay down some of the foundation, which is to say, in terms of the ships in the water, submarines in the water, aircraft in the air, they outgun the United States. Okay. So let me say one thing. You've mentioned that people are saying that the U.S. is hyping the threat. Who? If you read the U.S. DoD report each year, it is what we have characterized as threat deflation. Mm-hmm. That report has deflated the threat. It's not built up the threat. So when I hear this argument that somebody in America's threat elevating the threat, I can only think of, well, they're talking about me, because no one else in the U.S. national security establishment is talking about it. You just had Admiral James Stavridis, who you all should recognize from Europe. He just came out in the last month and said, oh, China's another decade away from being able to conduct an invasion. That's wrong. Okay. He is doing what we describe in our book. He's threat deflating. He's deflating the threat of the PRC. He served mostly in Europe. He maybe had a tour when he was a junior officer. He knows a couple of admirals in the Pacific. He's visited Taiwan, but he hasn't lived day to day and understand what the Chinese Navy does. And not only have they built all these platforms, but they're operating with them for 15 years every day. Every day for 15 years, the PLA Navy has manned an expeditionary or a naval escort task force in the Gulf of Aden. 15 years every day. Name another Navy that's done something like that. Even the U.S. Navy started gapping our carrier presence in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah.
Okay. We gapped the presence in the Pacific in 2003 when we sent the Kitty Hawk to Afghanistan. They've done 15 years of demonstration that they can maintain global naval operations, and they're building their fleets up. Their fleets are getting new and larger refueler ships, oilers, like the Type 901s, which are, you know, again, 40,000 tons, the same size as our Henry J. Kaiser class resupply and refueling ships. So they recognize logistics as key to maintaining the global Navy. And they're operating in that sense. They have more days underway than they ever did in terms of their days at sea for their ships, greatly increased. And when they operate in joint environments when they conduct training. So you'll have the rocket force, just like you saw in August of 22, joint sword in April of last year. You have these joint operations where the Navy, the Air Force, PLA Air Force, the PLA Rocket Force, even their ground forces are all coordinating together, focused on the mission of destroying the U.S. military. And the lead element of the U.S. military in the Pacific is obviously the Pacific Fleet, the 7th Fleet in particular. So that's what they train to. And they practice it. They practice it in other areas. They practice in the South China Sea. They practice in the East China Sea. They practice missile tests in the Bohai. So you have all this missiles being tested on various platforms that are in the Bohai underway. You had a demonstration a few years ago with the DF-21D and the DF-26 being shot into a closure area south of Hainan Island against a moving target.
And it hit the target. Was it successful?
That's all the reporting that I have seen says that. So you have, that's just in the last couple of years. I go back to when I was still in uniform and the things that I saw, and I can't go into the details, but what I saw was an integrated force that was practicing to do what I did and what I served in, was to, you know, take out the opposing Navy, the Soviet Navy. The Chinese have been building on that and working towards that end for 25 years. So when somebody tells me it's going to be another decade before they have a capability to do something, that's what we've been saying over and over. Oh, they'll never build an aircraft carrier. I remember arriving in Washington, D.C. in 2006, coming from the USS Kitty Hawk, and hearing, and I can't name names again, but hearing senior intelligence officers tell tell analysts, we're not going to write any reports that talk about Chinese aircraft carriers because there's no way they're going to have one. But it'll be decades and decades away. And now what did we see? From the space of 2012 to 2022, the Chinese have 3 aircraft carriers, and they got a 4th that's under construction.
Which so is a major feat, James. It's a major manufacturing feat, yes?
No, it's not just a manufacturing feat, because they're not just manufactured. They're out actually operating east of Taiwan. You have both Liaoning and Shandong are out doing operations east of Taiwan multiple times throughout the last year. Multiple times. Shandong Carrier Strike Group transiting, going down to the South China Sea, operating, heading east through the Bashi, and then operating for a week or two east of the Philippines or east of Taiwan and flying 600-700 sorties. Now, the aircraft is a ski jump carrier. It doesn't have a steam catapult. It can't launch the same numbers of aircraft. I got it. I served on carriers for 20 years. I know what the difference is. They're not as capable as our carriers. But in the context of being able to use those carriers in a Taiwan invasion scenario, they have now demonstrated with both of them. And remember, the first one, they told us for years, was just going to be a training carrier. Then they switched that language, and now it's an operational carrier.
And now the new one has the electromagnetic catapult, I guess, right? The new one that they had just sailed into to sea, right, recently.
It hasn't started sea trials officially yet. We're waiting for that. It's done pier side testing of the power plant. And we've also seen some video of what looks to be a load shot off the electromagnetic cat launch in port that somebody took from a commercial plane.
So you find all those comments from around the world that look down upon the Chinese capabilities to innovate, to invent, to manufacture as a condescending, piece of, ignorance, yeah? Basically, James, that's how...
Well, I think it's hubris, and I also think there's a bit of racism there. And I would just direct everybody to remind people is go back and read what the experts said about the Imperial Japanese Navy before 1940. Read what they said. The same things. Japanese can't produce quality aircraft carriers, quality fighters. They don't have the training. They don't have this. They have poor eyesight. They wear glass. All kinds of things were written by experts that said the Imperial Japanese Navy could not pull off an attack like they did at Pearl Harbor. And oh, by the way, for strategic mistakes that the Japanese made by not following up and going further faster, the war would have been dramatically different. Because we didn't survive. We survived by a hair thread over the next 2.5 years until that 1940 Two Ocean Navy Ship Act kicked into, had gone into production and finally started pumping out the kinds of ships that we needed to get our numbers up and our capabilities up. So this idea that we're somehow the Chinese aren't capable or they're not intelligent enough or they don't have innovation or, I've heard arguments, I hear this argument, well, they have a problem with people. They don't have enough qualified carrier pilots. And you're like, have you been to China? You know how many people are in China? Have you ever gone on a Chinese Navy base? I have. You ever seen Chinese ships? Have you ever seen Chinese cities? There's people everywhere. It's 1.2, 1.3, 1.4. It's a bit over a billion people. People are not their problem. And they've been building. They have a naval academy that they built over the last 10 years that they built on the exact model of Annapolis, except that it's 4 times as big. People don't know that. People don't talk about that, that the Chinese are training people. They're pumping people out. And if you're a poor farmer in central China, remember, even though Xi Jinping said there's no more poverty in China, the fact of the matter remains, China is still a very poor country in many areas outside the coastal area.
Speaking
so if you're a farmer, and getting to go into serve in your military, it's very much like the Reagan buildup of the 1980s in America, where regular Americans could go into the military and have a career, like I did. There's people in China doing the same thing, and they have the same pride and prestige, and they're building a military that they want to be like the basically the U.S. Navy of the 80s in terms of power and dominance versus others.
Going aside for a while, speaking about Japanese Navy, Imperial Navy, that interested me a lot. So you posted that they had capabilities to really defeat the U.S. Navy in the Pacific, defeat the Hawaii, say even blockade the western coast because of the different strategic calculations. This is what you think that could have happened, that was a close call?
I don't know if they could have blockaded the west coast. I don't think that, but I think clearly it was you just have to read a number of history books to know that in Hawaii, that if the Japanese had regrouped and come back and attacked Pearl Harbor again, when the carriers had to come back in, it would have been dramatically different if they had taken out the last few remaining aircraft carriers. It would have been a dramatically different war. We wouldn't have had a victory at Coral Sea. And when you start taking away some of these victories, you don't know. So the point being is that we, in the 30s and in the early 40s before Pearl Harbor, the establishment was downplaying the threat, or we call threat deflation, against the Japanese. And we are seeing the same kind of arrogance and hubris today from the very people that should be taking the opposite. So, read the Defense Department reports over the last two decades. There is no, you don't see here a bell saying, warning, 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 China's rising. You just, it's always deflated. It's always downplayed. It's always, it's decades away.
And it's even, in comparison with the Imperial Japanese Navy, the shipyard capacity of the U.S. is much smaller than the Chinese ones. So it's the opposite as it was with the Japanese shipyards. And also the Chinese Navy, the Chinese forces would need to fight close to their own shores with a heavy rocket, formidable rocket force supporting it. Yeah. And also there were, voices saying, Chinese rockets, who cares? I mean, again, the same condescending factor, while in my opinion, this is a major factor in any contingency in the Western Pacific, right? What do you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just fighting the Navy. You're fighting the complete joint force. Remember, they just announced the new head of the Minister of Defense, former Chief of the Navy, okay? He was, in one of his first jobs, he ran, I believe it's the new Minister of Defense, he was the first, he was the chief of the first East China Sea Joint Command Center in Fujian. Okay.
Opposing Taiwan.
Right. So this admiral who's now running the PLA, oh, by the way, that we could talk about that. That's a whole interesting thing because everybody focused on the purges of Strategic Rocket Force and others, but they don't want to talk about the fact that who they put in charge of the Ministry of Defense. In the PRC now. He's a Navy admiral, and he's got extensive experience in the problem set of Taiwan. So he's in place. He's got experience in joint command and control. And so this force is been operating and training together in joint operations. And I think, I don't know if we discussed it the last time, but when we were in a previous discussion I had with others, when we talk about the reaction and how the Chinese decided to use the Pelosi visit to test out their joint or their invasion strategy, Taiwan invasion strategy, which is composed of this joint fire strike campaign, joint anti-air raid campaign, and then finally the joint island landing campaign. We saw elements of that. First of all, they're joint. So in August of 22, after Pelosi left, you saw Strategic Rocket Force, actual missiles being fired, 11 of them, bracketing around Taiwan. And then you had the operations of the PLA Air Force, the PLA Ground Forces were supporting, and obviously the PLA Navy. So it's a joint operation to demonstrate that this first phase or first campaign of a Taiwan invasion, the Joint Fire Strike Campaign, was executed. Then in April of 23, during the Joint Sword Exercise, you saw what could be characterized, at least I can, of what would be considered a joint anti-air raid campaign, where the rocket force was still involved and things of that nature, but it was more heavily influenced or focused on air, establishing air control, air supremacy. Eventually, they want air superiority over Taiwan. That would be the second element. And then finally, you could launch the invasion.
Now, what do you think about those leaks that has been, you know, in recent years from DC and the Pentagon, saying that, you know, in all those games, war games that they had played, it's very difficult for the U.S. to project power over Taiwan, to sustain Air Force operations over Taiwan, and basically this is a death zone. So, you know, we need to think twice how to, you know, approach this. What do you think about all those leaks from war games, you know, sort of? What's the real situation? What's the balance of power, basically? Correlation of forces in any contingency over Taiwan these days. And that, of course, as we all know, is a major factor in decision-making processes, either in Beijing or in DC, if there is any crisis looming.
Right. Well, clearly they are leaks, like the Bloomberg leak about the purges, and then, or the, not the purges, but the reports about an intelligence community assessment that says that the strategic rocket force was put, that Xi was so angry that he fired these people because he found out that they were putting water in their in the fuel cells of these rockets and other nonsense like that. Two things first. In our book and in my experience of 30 years in the system, the intelligence community and the DOD and the State Department downplayed the threat, downplayed the concerns. And for years, I can remember briefing realities and what was happening in early 2000. Here's what the Chinese are doing. And I was always kind of, you're trying to hype the threat. There's really nothing there. Don't worry about it. And they downplayed it. But now what you're just seeing in this last 6 to 10, 12 months is there's now a new school of thought that's coming out, which is to what you had said much earlier, which is there are some people that are saying, you can't win. It's over. China's got a lock on it militarily.
Yeah.
And that's the same people that said there was no threat. And I won't name names, but there are some analysts out there that if you go back and read what they said 10, 12, 15 years ago about the PRC, they said there's nothing to worry about. Now they're the same ones that are saying it's over.
It's a done deal, yeah?
It's a done deal. So I want to be clear in this broadcast with you that when I talk about the Chinese threat, that I have been consistent over the course of my professional career on predicting this, one, and two, it's not a sense of defeatism or inevitability that the PRC wins, even though they have numbers advantage, and they have geography advantage, and they have timing that they get to choose because it's theirs when they want to. That is no reason for the United States and the rest of the world to give up, because the implications for Taiwan to have fallen and fall to the People's Republic of China does not bode well for anyone in the world. For obviously, in just the chip sector, you know, if China is able to destroy or take control of 90% of the world's high-quality chips, they can control that and use that as leverage like they have with rare earth elements and any other thing that they use. So that's not good. Plus, we know that they're a dystopian totalitarian dictatorship. and we saw what they did to, you know, over a billion people during COVID and how they felt no, you know, compulsion about locking people down, throwing people into prisons, locking people up, welding them inside their apartments. All we saw the videos, we know it. So, and now we're getting more and more evidence that says that, yeah, it looks very clearly like the virus came from the Chinese. They knew about it. They delayed reporting it to the world. We just learned this in the last few weeks. We didn't learn it, but it's just now coming out again that there's more evidence that supports that. The point is that the Chinese Communist Party has a global vision, a global domination that they want to have. And so if we think that, well, Taiwan, we can't defend it because they got such a large military and it's just 100 miles off their coast and it's not really worth dying for, well, think again. Because once they take that, that changes the dynamic, not just in the Western Pacific, but around the globe in terms of Chinese military and economic power. And so,
yeah, I mean, they can project power easily into the Pacific because they control the central part of the first island chain then, and they have multiple ports east on the east port of Taiwan. Basically, the Japanese lifetime is threatened by blockades, technically. And, you know, they have a buffer zone to protect their mainland as well by Taiwan and, you know, sort of the Ryukyu and Hainan. It's a major game changer, I think, from the maritime strategy perspective, if they seize Taiwan. Not to mention semiconductors, you know, Taiwan and so on, population. So, but I'm having the last question because we need to head towards the end. You know, we have talked about China, U.S., navies and some, but what do you think about the efforts of the Japanese Navy, Japanese forces? Are they catching up on the reality or not? There are some, you know, reports that the Japanese are coordinating efficiently with the U.S. about shipyard repairs, about, you know, escorting, about different aspects. But on the other hand, I also heard and talked to many analysts that the Taiwanese don't do a thing, and they fake preparations. Also to make sure that the Americans are on day one in defense of their island. So this is the strategy on purpose, that they seemingly do not modernize properly, so that, you know, the Americans have to defend it on day one. So how would you comment on that? Would you agree with that? Would you oppose that?
No, I think it's a fair statement, but I think it's driven by basically an American foreign policy, again, this failure to understand the strategic threat from China. So we have bipartisan efforts over the last 20 years to tell the Taiwanese to be quiet and to stay non-provocative. Is that ringing in on the...
No, it's not ringing me, so...
Okay. I think I am supposed to be on another talk and I forgot. Anyway.
Sure.
You'll have to obviously clip this out. So to answer your question, over the last 20 years, the U.S. has told the Taiwanese to not be provocative. Do not provoke. We remember in 2004, former Secretary of State Tom Christensen told President Chen Shui-bian at a speech in Annapolis in a very public setting, hey, we can't have you talking like this because you're going to start a war. Mm-hmm. So that's been our consistent message. What has come a result of that is exactly what your question said, which is a nation that's not fully militarily prepared.
Yeah.
So the Trump administration was the first ones to kind of reverse that. And when they lifted many of the restrictions that allowed the Taiwanese to build their own indigenous submarine, that had been promised by the Bush administration and never followed up by anyone until Trump came in and lifted those restrictions on sharing submarine technology, which then enabled the Taiwanese to build their boat. We need to ramp that up, in my opinion. We need to help the Taiwanese become a hard target for China. And that's going to take some time in certain areas. So that's why I've been kind of vocal, and this is going to sound very controversial, but I've been a very strong advocate of, we're at the point in time that tensions are so dangerous. And we just had Admiral Aquilino in Washington warning about a major demonstration by the PLA in the aftermath of this election, that we're in such a dangerous position that we could lose Taiwan, that we need to introduce theater nuclear weapons again into Taiwan. And it has to be very difficult, dangerous coordination, and not dangerous, but difficult to coordinate with Taiwan. And it's a reversal of our past policies, but that needs to be done because Beijing hasn't had to calculate that. And so
are we heading towards the war soon, James?
We could be if we don't deter Beijing. Mm-hmm. If we do not deter Beijing, they will see this as an opportunity to strike. And my fear is that if, you know, things go in November, if Biden doesn't come in, they may delay, or if Biden does come in, they may think they have a little bit more time, maybe till 2027. If Trump is elected, they may say, we were not going to have much more time, so let's go now. So either way, it's going to happen in this decade, in my opinion, because the timeline that I talked about, this having this great rejuvenation ceremony in 2049, that we talked in the last broadcast, You can't get to that great rejuvenation ceremony until you clean up this loose end of Taiwan, at least in their mind, in this decade.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, James. Our guest today was James Kim O'Fanell, a former Chief Intelligence Officer, Director of Intelligence of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Thank you very much for this conversation, the sobering one again. Looking forward to hearing from you again soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jason. My pleasure.